Hello again, and welcome to this, the third podcast in the series detailing the rise and falls of yours truly. In 1965, I finally went overseas. Well, okay, over the channel. It may have been less than 30 miles, but it still felt like a big adventure. Dawn was breaking as the ferry approached Ostend, and the excitement I felt at visiting a foreign country for the first time was only slightly diminished by the response of a number of passengers around me who became very excited when they spotted a quayside tavern with a neon sign advertising fish and chips. I'd had a good journey down to Folkestone. People seemed more than happy to stop. And when I was whisked the last 100 miles to London in a sleek Volvo P1800, driven with some spirit by a young and very attractive American woman, I thought that life on the open road with nothing more than a backpack, a willing thumb and a big grin was positively the only way to live. Throughout that trip, I was greeted warmly by everyone I met. And the Italian teenagers who befriended me on the beach at Ostia were especially warm. I must admit that once I mentioned that Liverpool was my hometown, smiles grew wider. The Beatles had managed to make it the very centre of the world. They had, contrary to my prediction, conquered the mighty home of rock and roll. The year before, on February the 1st, 1964, I Wanna Hold Your Hand had shot to number one in the USA, and the first British sortie was successful. A week later, the invasion started in earnest when the Beatles landed at the John F. Kennedy Airport in New York. The reception was rapturous, and the total capture of the country was secured on the 9th of February, when an estimated 73 million Americans tuned in to the Ed Sullivan Show. Beatlemania hit the USA. On April the 4th, Can't Buy Me Love, Twist and Shout, She Loves You, I Wanna Hold Your Hand, and Please Please Me held the top 5 places on the Billboard Top 40 singles. That was unprecedented. And then, in Jacksonville, Florida, on September the 11th, a different kind of 9/11, John Lennon announced that the Beatles would not play to a segregated audience. A segregated audience in the free world in 1964, just 2 months before Martin Luther King became the youngest person ever to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. But abuses of justice weren't just happening in the USA. On the other side of the Atlantic, south of the equator, Nelson Mandela was just beginning a life sentence on Robben Island. And of course, 1964 saw the build-up of US armed forces in Vietnam, as well as the first response by American students. Demonstrations were held in Times Square, New York, San Francisco, Seattle, and Madison, Wisconsin. And on May the 12th, 12 young men burnt their draft cards. In Britain, Harold Wilson, Member of Parliament for my own Highton constituency, became the Prime Minister, and the Daily Herald was replaced by the Sun. In the summer of 1965, I wasn't the only one making a run for it. The train robber, Ronald Biggs, managed to escape from Wandsworth prison. Yeah, he obviously had help. And so did I. Yeah, I meant nothing but warmth on my trip to Rome. And I wanted to see if that warmth, extended beyond Europe. 18 months after returning from my hitchhiking holiday, I set off again, this time through France and Spain. At the time, I remember thinking, so why isn't everybody doing this? Unfortunately, everybody wasn't doing this. And I suppose the sensible reason everybody wasn't doing this was summed up by a friend I'd been at school with. Somebody who had shared my passion for poring over world maps and planning a trip that would take us to those faraway places with strange-sounding names. But sane practicality swept aside romantic adventure. He said, "How long are you planning to go away for?" I said, "I don't know. Until I think I should come back." He said, "Rich, have you thought this through? What about a career? What about a pension?" I said, "I'm 19. I might not be healthy enough to enjoy the retirement when it comes. I'll take it now." Was that really all there was to it? Or was there a bit of David Copperfield when he learns that his mother has died? And he says, "If ever child was stricken with sincere grief, I was." But I remember that this importance was a kind of satisfaction to me. When I walked in the playground that afternoon while the boys were in school, when I saw them glancing out of the windows as they went up to their classes, I felt distinguished and looked more melancholy and walked slower. When school was over and they came out and spoke to me, I felt it rather good in myself not to be proud to any of them and to take exactly the same notice of them as before. Well, I could sincerely say that, like Ulysses, I wished to sail beyond the sunset. But was I also thinking that I felt distinguished? And not seeking to look more melancholy, but maybe more windswept and interesting, as Billy Connolly would say. You know, perhaps some of my desire to smite the sounding furrows was fueled by the same bravado that led me to dismiss Linda's firm conviction that four fellas from Liverpool might just make it. And even if only for a brief interval, persuade the world into believing that all you need is love.